supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Last week, 28-year-old Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez stunned the Democratic establishment by capturing the party's congressional nomination in the Bronx, running as a Democratic socialist. WHYY's Dave Davies reports that some national analysts now see a socialist surge in the party, one that includes a Philadelphian and two Western Pennsylvania women who won state House primaries.
A prominent column in Sunday's New York Times featured Philadelphian Elizabeth Fiedler and other women candidates with the headline, "The Millennial Socialists Are Coming." Fiedler's winning state House campaign was endorsed by the Democratic Socialists of America, but she doesn't describe herself as one.
I don't really apply many labels to myself, but I'm the daughter of two union public school teachers, and I'm really proud to work on behalf of working people of South Philly on everything, economy, job creation, healthcare, everything.
The DSA wasn't the driving force behind Fiedler's candidacy, but the socialists' agenda, including Medicare for all and free college tuition, seemed to energize younger voters. DSA National Committee member Natalie Madiri says the organization has seen enormous growth.
We're an organization of 40,000 members now. We're able to take on much more ambitious political work, and I would say we have much more influence openly as socialists since the Bernie Sanders campaign.
But traditional Democrats note that winning low turnout primaries is far different from appealing to moderates in a general election. Former Pennsylvania Democratic Chairman T.J. Rooney says he's excited to have socialists getting new voters involved. He says moderate Democrats in mainstream districts will be able to distinguish their approaches and appeal to independent voters.
You can't win in places like Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, with a socialist message. But you can win in places like Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, with a Democratic message. And, I think the two can peacefully coexist within the same larger tent.
Dave Davies, WHYY News.
The $34.7 billion New Jersey annual state budget signed into law late last night is expected to produce a $765 million surplus by the end of next June. That, though, must come as cold comfort to the 193 school districts that will sustain budget cuts in the coming year. Joining me with details is Ryan Hutchins, Politico's New Jersey Bureau Chief. Ryan, thanks for helping us make sense of the numbers on NewsWorks Tonight.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So let's focus on the school funding formula. It was a hard-won fight, I presume, by Senate President Steve Sweeney, who was able to convince Governor Murphy to more or less come over to his plan that he's been touting now for around a year.
This has been an issue for him for many years, and he basically set a red line here that he was ready to shut state government down. The Senate president was ready to shut state government down if he did not get his way on school funding, if they didn't make these sort of changes. Now, this final deal gets them to about another $350 million in aid to schools. That brings the total to about $8.5 billion a year that Trenton is shipping around the state to prop up local districts.
Who are the biggest winners in this new formula?
So it's a mix, right? There are districts across the state that have been overfunded that are both large and, some media size and even small, wealthy districts that have been It received tons of funding, in particular these former Abbott schools, these urban school districts that had struggled, received tons of funding. So, for example, under this plan, the Chesterfield School District in Burlington County, it's the state's most underfunded school system, and they would see a jump in state aid from $821,000 to $2.4 million. That's a 193% increase. And then Jersey City, which is the most overfunded district, is going to see its state aid drop from $410.4 million to $406 million. But it's only a decrease of 0.9%. So because they have more money, they're able to, direct more of it to schools that are underfunded.
Let's look at implications for other forms of revenue generating, namely the tax on multimillionaires and corporations.
The governor had proposed, and he campaigned on this last year, a tax on those making more than $1 million per year. he had proposed in March a 10.75% rate. They went back and forth with lawmakers. Steve Sweeney, the Senate president, fought him at every turn on this, despite previously supporting something like half a dozen different attempts under the Chris Christie administration to get a millionaire's tax in place. And so he fought that. And what they ended up with was a tax on mega millionaires, those making more than $5 million every year. There's fewer than, I believe, 2,000 people paying it. By going from a threshold of people making more than $1 million to people making more than $5 million a year, they've cut out, by the governor's own measure, 21,000 millionaires who will not be subject to this tax. Among them, the governor himself, Phil Murphy, who made a little bit less than $5 million the last time we had his tax returns.
How about the onus on corporations?
All corporations making more than $1 million a year are going to face a surcharge of 2.5% over the next 2 years. That's on top of their current 9%. Now, that will give the state one of the highest corporate business tax rates in America.
We've touched on millionaires, mega millionaires. How about the average family in New Jersey? What effect will they feel as a result of this?
So there are, you know, there are a few, you know, taxes that will, you know, hit people in general. Taxes on Airbnb, it's not a ton of money. The state's expecting $15 million. So if you use like Airbnb or another app like that to rent a house on the shore, you might pay a little more. There's also a tax on e-cigarettes that could raise about $17 million. And then also on, you know, ride-hail companies like Uber and Lyft, they're expecting about $12 million from that.
Not to be cavalier, but $15, $17, and $12 million is chump change in the context of a $34 billion budget.
It absolutely is. Not included in this is a sales tax proposal that the governor had sought. He would have restored the sales tax up to 7%. The governor was expecting more than $700 million in revenue from that. And in this final deal he caved, he agreed not to do it because he got some other revenues.
Ryan, thanks so much for bringing us up to speed on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Ryan Hutchins is Politico's New Jersey Bureau Chief. Governor Phil Murphy recently signed a law to save three struggling nuclear plants in New Jersey. That rescue plan does not include the Oyster Creek nuclear plant in Lacey Township. The Exelon plant will permanently shut down by mid-September. But according to federal officials, the actual removal of contaminated components won't start until the year 2075, almost 60 years from now. And without a federal plan to store nuclear waste, it will stay in the Garden State for years. Details from State Impact Pennsylvania's Catalina Jaramillo.
Oyster Creek nuclear plant will stop generating electricity in September. But instead of immediately dismantling the building and removing contamination from the site, Exelon says it is safer to wait for the radiation to naturally decrease. That wait could stretch out over 57 years. Jeff Tittle, director of the New Jersey Sierra Club, says that's too long.
50 years from now is an awful long time, especially in an ever-changing coastal area.
The Oyster Creek nuclear plant is located a few miles from the beach. Tittle and residents of homes surrounding the plant worry rising sea levels and strong storms could flood the facility.
The longer we wait and the longer things sit there, the more chances of another storm that could be even worse than Sandy hits the plant and spreading that radiation into the community behind it.
But the United States Nuclear Regulatory Commission says that won't happen. Exelon plans to move the spent fuel to safe dry casks units in the next 5.5 years. And once that happens, the commission says the risk will be minimal. Bruce Watson is an expert in nuclear safety from the commission.
The safety significance of having the spent fuel in dry storage is very low.
Commission spokesman Neil Sheehan says the casks have been exposed to all kinds of conditions to guarantee they're safe.
These casks have been subjected to all kinds of tests, including submersion, They've been dropped. They've been, you know, ignited. There have been a variety of tests and conditions that they've been subjected to.
The Nuclear Regulatory Commission will hold a public meeting in Lacey Township on July 17 to hear public comments on Exelon's plan for dismantling the plant. Catalina Jaramillo, WHYY News.
For most people, summer is synonymous with vacation. But for those who make money off of those vacationers, this season is all business. Over the next couple of months, we'll be offering stories about the business of summer. To start us off, WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Aaron takes us to the middle of the Delaware River.
On a mild stretch of river just south of Frenchtown, New Jersey, you'll find the perfect blend of classical elements. There's water, wind, and fire.
When I go on the river to this day, all my problems go away.
That's Greg Kranz. He's responsible for the fire part. In the late 80s, a local businessman came to Kranz with a problem. The businessman rented tubes to people who would float down the river and sometimes trash the place in the process. The people who owned fancy homes on the Pennsylvania side of the river weren't exactly happy with him.
They were complaining that people would, during a storm, would go across their property or they would bring coolers or alcohol.
The businessman told Kranz he should open a hot dog stand in the middle of the river. It would tempt the tubers to stay toward the other bank instead of crisscrossing all over the neighbor's property. Plus, it would keep them from bringing their own food and trashing up the river.
I said, nah, that's a crazy idea. And then he brought it up again a week or two later. And we said, all right, we'll give it a try. And that's when we were all joking around. Oh, yeah, we're going to be the famous river hot dog man. And we went out and did it.
Over 31 years, Kranz has become kind of famous, at least among the thousands of tubers who float by his stand on summer days. The business started on the banks of a small island, but today, he and his family sell hot dogs, burgers, nachos, candy bars, chips, and sodas from a floating barge in the middle of the Delaware River.
Can you get a hot dog, chips, and a drink?
Yes. I've had JOBs, and I never want to go back. My office is, you know, usually the boat.
These days, Kranz has ceded a lot of the work to his four sons. Matthew is the chief operating officer.
I'm a hot dog man, but he's the original hot dog man.
15 years ago, the family opened their own tubing business, Delaware River Tubing. Together with the hot dog stand, they make enough money to get by. But it can be a fickle trade.
Our weekend business is 60% of the organization, so if we lose 2 weekends... that hurts us big time. I mean, we're only dealing with 12 solid weeks of operation.
Matt's salary can fluctuate wildly from year to year based on how good the weather is on those 24 days of weekend during the summer. We're talking tens of thousands of dollars.
River taketh, river giveth.
So how does the famous river hot dog man stay sane given the crazy swings in his bottom line?
I don't handle the sanity all too well. Take pills for that.
And working on the water, it turns out, is its own form of medicine.
It still has that soothing effect on it. So if you haven't been out there and you haven't tried it, you need to. And you need to come with us. You need to see the hot dog man. You need to kick back, listen to some music, and let your kids tear the place up. We don't care. They can't hurt it.
But Kranz says this is more than a business pitch to him. He considers tubing a form of what he calls conservation by immersion.
We need the Delaware. And everyone needs to appreciate it. So what I mean by immersion is people come, they go in, just letting them have that experience, seeing how clean it is, pristine. Hopefully thousands of people go back home and realize how important it is to keep it that way.
One dip in the Delaware, Kranz says, and you'll appreciate everything the river offers. And of course, you can't appreciate anything fully on an empty stomach. Avi Wolfman-Aaron, WHYY News.
Independence Day is sandwiched between Tuesday, the start of the dog days of summer, and aphelion on Thursday. Let's consult the calendar with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, is there an astronomical significance to the advent of the dog days?
As it turns out, there is, Dave. This actually began a long, long time ago, 3,000 years ago, during the height of the Egyptian civilization. It was recognized at that time that one of the brightest stars in the evening sky, the star Sirius, is part of the constellation Canis Major, the big dog. Sirius is the bright jewel in the collar of the dog. And during this time of year, the star Sirius happens to be in the sky at the same time as the sun. So Egyptian mythology had it that the heat from Sirius plus the heat from our sun at this time of the year contributed to the great heat in Egypt at the time. And so, because this was the star in the collar of the dog, Canis Major, this time was recognized as the dog days of summer.
Of course, now with modern technology, what percent of the heat of summer is generated by Sirius?
About 0% of the heat from Sirius affects us.
Got it. Now, we'll save the 4th of July history lesson for another time, but what's aphelion?
Well, aphelion actually is that point in the Earth's orbit where we are at our greatest distance from the sun. Happens to be this week, this Thursday. And so while we would be tempted to think that the temperatures are really warm during the summer because we're so much closer to the sun, it's actually the opposite. The Earth at this point is 94,508,000 miles away from the sun, as compared to the opposite time of year, winter, in January, when on January 3rd or January 4th, typically, we're 91,403,000 miles away. So you might wonder, what is it that makes things so warm here if we're so much further away? And it is that, at this point in our orbit around the sun, the northern half of the Earth is tilted toward the sun. This means that radiation coming from the sun is much more concentrated as it strikes the northern portion of the Earth, and that makes the ground heat up, it makes the oceans heat up. When you combine that tilt along with the great arc of the sun across the sky because of that tilt, giving us the greater number of hours of daylight, what we end up with is this opportunity for heating to take place that raises the temperature of everything.
Let's focus on some 4th of July astronomical anniversaries of note. We touched on Sirius. Let's migrate over to the Crab Nebula.
Yes. In the constellation Taurus, we find one of the most significant supernovae of all time, and that is the Crab Nebula supernova, which exploded on January 4th, 1054 AD. Now, this star was so incredibly explosive that it was bright enough to be seen in the daytime sky for 3 weeks. And this was observed by astronomers all over the planet, but it was reported by those astronomers in the East and in the Far East. So if we look at Korean astronomical records, Chinese, Japanese, and even Arabic astronomical records, we'll find note of this particular event. It wasn't found in Western records, mostly because of the fact that it wasn't really proper, according to religious belief, to identify a new star in the sky. Western religion said that all the stars had been created already, so there couldn't be a new one. But this star was still well recognized, even though it may not have been recorded as such. It finally faded from sight 2 years later. 2 years later. So this was quite the event.
Since 1054, has there been another time when a competing entity has been visible in the daytime sky?
Yes, indeed. Supernova 1987A, which was discovered by astronomers observing the night sky in the southern hemisphere while at the observatory one night. That supernova was just barely visible during the day, but it was the most recent supernova that we know of note.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller. NewsWorks Tonight.